Hey everyone, welcome back to the Art of Travel podcast. Today's special guest is Isabel Sandoval. Isabel is a director and actress best known for her critically acclaimed film, Lingua Franca, now streaming on Netflix. Lingua Franca is a semi-autobiographical story of a transgender migrant in New York named Olivia. In the film, Olivia is a caretaker, seeking to obtain a green card through an arranged marriage. Desperate to obtain legal residency, the film deals with Olivia's anxiety around deportation, ICE raids, and gender identity. The film also beautifully captures some much more nuanced moments, with scenes that illuminate the sacrifice and struggles migrants face to support families back home. In this conversation, Isabel shares with us her many journeys, how her move from Manila to New York not only prompted her path to cinema, but to trans womanhood as well. Let's get Isabel on the line. Isabel, thank you so much for joining me today here on the Art of Travel podcast. Where in the world are you right now?
I am in Raleigh in North Carolina.
And what are you doing in Raleigh?
I actually moved down here from New York back in June. I have a cousin and his partner who lives here, and they've been badgering me for years to come visit. And I haven't had the time to do so, but with the pandemic, I decided to finally come visit and I decided to stay.
Oh, that's great. And is this where you're currently based full time?
Yes. Although me and my fiance are considering moving to Los Angeles in June. I feel like I've been just hopping around since the quarantine.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Los Angeles is going to be a perfect fit given your vocation.
Yes.
We're happy to welcome you here once you arrive.
Yeah.
And there's a huge Filipino community, so it'll feel closer to home, I think.
Yeah, I'm very excited. And also in terms of the climate, you know, in terms of the weather.
So I wanted to just get started on talking about your career. How did you get your start in filmmaking?
I actually have a pretty unorthodox background as a filmmaker. I do not have a formal film education. I was born and raised in the Philippines in Cebu, which is the second largest city after Manila. And I have an undergraduate degree in psychology and then a master's degree in business. So I have an MBA where I specialize not in finance, so I specialize in marketing and media and entertainment. You know, while I was at NYU for business school, I managed to intern for Focus Features. But ever since I was a kid, I've always been in love with the movies. And one of my earliest childhood memories is my mom taking me, four-year-old me, to a movie palace in downtown Cebu, and we watched this comedy starring the Filipino Charlie Chaplin. And I just remember being in awe of, you know, this gigantic image projected onto this massive screen. And I realized early on that I was a creative person. And my creative outlet was I would come up with, you know, these images that were like essentially scenes in a movie that I would string together and become a movie in my mind. And when I graduated from business school, I decided to just finally take the plunge and work on my first short film, which then became my first feature that happened to be selected at one of the prestigious festivals in Europe. And that got me started in my filmmaking journey.
That's incredible. And actually, that's really interesting that you studied psychology, because looking at your films now, that makes so much sense. I read in one of your past interviews, you talked about how you really like to take the audience through an emotional journey and you try to bring them to a destination. And I find that super interesting. In what ways does psychology play a huge role in sort of the centralizing force behind your films?
Psychology plays a huge part in my filmmaking because my work tends to be very character driven. And, you know, characters are truly complicated and complex and layered. And my training in psychology just gave me a better handle in terms of really developing and defining my characters, especially because, you know, with Lingua Franca, which is my latest feature, I essentially work with a main protagonist that's otherwise, you know, like invisible or voiceless in American cinema. And my psychology background came in really handy in really fleshing her out as a three-dimensional character, where, and not only a three-dimensional character, she's a character that's more interior. She's introverted, and I, you know, work with the medium of cinema, which is visual, in terms of really conveying and really bringing to life her interior emotional and psychological state.
By the way, I am such a big fan of Lingua Franca. I watched it last weekend, and it's a movie that really sits with you. I feel like the more you sort of simmer and think about it, the more that you really get to see all the layers involved in the character development. As you mentioned, it was really beautiful and nuanced.
Thank you. Thanks, Olivia. Yeah, that was really my goal in making Lingua Franca. You know, I mean, we're used to, you know, sitting down to watch a movie for either an hour and a half or 2 hours, and then, you know, expecting the conflicts and the dilemmas of the characters to get resolved, you know, and tied up in a neat bow by the end of the film, and we can go back to our comfortable lives. But I wanted this film to be about this undocumented Filipina trans woman to linger, you know, in the minds of viewers and to haunt them. And I consider it a victory for myself as a filmmaker if I'm able to make a work of art that really stays with the audience and gets them to think more deeply and more profoundly about the themes touched on in the film.
I would love to talk more about Lingua Franca because it's such a gripping piece of work, and it deals very directly with the fears of undocumented Filipino caretakers in the U.S. and around the world. Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you to showcase this narrative?
You know, I belong to these communities. I'm a Filipino American. I'm an immigrant, you know, to the U.S. I'm a trans woman as well. And I've said before that Olivia, you know, Lingua Franca is not autobiographical. It's still a work of fiction. But I do identify with Olivia because we are both Filipina trans women living in New York. And because someone like me, a minority filmmaker in the U.S., rarely gets the chance to make our own films, I wanted the opportunity that I was given to really matter. And that's why I decided to choose, you know, I decided to tell this particular story. Because if someone like me did not tell a story, I mean, who would? And I also wanted to, you know, take the opportunity not just, you know, make a film like Lingua Franca for the sake of representation and diversity, but to also showcase what makes my voice as an artist and as a filmmaker unique and singular.
When you were developing Lingua Franca, was there an intention to always incorporate some of Trump's newscast rhetoric into the film, or was that something that developed sort of in live time as the news were progressing and becoming increasingly anti-immigrant?
The story is set during the Trump administration, and it's really about Olivia, the main protagonist, trying to isolate herself or seclude herself from the threat of deportation that's looming around her. But I also wanted to show that just because having lived through that, you know, time myself, I'm glad to say that it's in the past tense, but, you know, just because he is all over, you know, in social media and the news always covers Trump, it's inevitable that we come across him, you know, either in news reports or even on the radio. And that's why I wanted to include that radio dispatch of Trump speaking. Like he's, you know, it's inevitable to come across, you know, Trump having lived through that time.
And it's very impactful. And the funny thing about it, it's kind of crazy to think in hindsight that that was like our daily reality, even just as news consumers.
Yeah, exactly.
that was actually like the fear-inducing sort of rhetoric that we were confronted mm-hmm. with every day. So I wanted to ask you that as a trans woman, your role as a director is breaking a lot of new ground in the industry. What has this journey been like for you?
It's been really quite surreal because when I made Lingua Franca, I can say that I made a film that was truly uncompromising and that was truly authentic, and in that I wasn't trying to pander to a mainstream cisgender audience. Lingua Franca, unlike a lot of features that tend to be about the experience of transgender individuals. It's not transgender for dummies. You know, there are scenes in the film, for instance, Olivia is dilating, which a lot of post-op trans women do, but I'm not explaining what she's actually doing. And in fact, some people think that she is like masturbating in that scene in the film. And for the film to resonate with viewers and audiences from very different backgrounds is, I think, a testament to the triumph of art, you know, to enable people to empathize with the characters that you're portraying on screen.
You sort of ended the film in a very open-ended scene. And I'm dying to know, as a viewer, did Olivia and Alex end up getting married?
She parts ways with Alex. Olivia is a resilient person. And yeah, I think the dilemma that she ultimately has in the film as she's slow dancing with Alex in that bar is that, you know, and he makes the offer to marry her. It's like, should I take the easy way out, get married to this man and get my green card? But then also, do I want to marry a person who exploited my deepest fears and anxieties and as an undocumented immigrant and who betrayed my trust ultimately? And it's at that moment where the audience realizes that Olivia is more than just an undocumented person looking for a path to citizenship or a trans woman looking for love. She's far more complex and, you know, layered than we think her to be. And that's where my psychology background really came in handy. I also wanted to have an open ending in the film to highlight the point that even though the movie has come to its conclusion, the overarching issues of immigration and the plight of transgender people in the U.S. Continues to be unresolved. And I want the audience to be unsettled and disturbed enough by the themes that are brought up in the film that would hopefully compel them to ask themselves, what can they do, you know, for people in their own community?
Yeah, I think it was definitely powerful. And, you know, as you said, to your point, I've become emotionally invested in the well-being of Olivia. Like, what happens to her next? Does she end up staying in the country? Does she end up finding a solution?
I think so. If she's made it that far in the U.S. at that point, now that Trump is out of the picture, I think her, you know, her future is a lot more hopeful, cautiously optimistic, as I would say, but she continues to survive and take it one day at a time, being the resilient immigrant that she is.
And I'm so curious to learn, what has been your own journey as a trans woman?
I'm very, very fortunate in that I transitioned in a city in the U.S. that's really progressive and liberal, and that's New York City. And in the sense, I feel like I underwent my gender transition in a bubble. Since I transitioned, I don't really remember one day when I left the house and had to worry very much about whether I'll be subjected to violence or harassment or explicit acts of discrimination and prejudice. I guess that is a privilege in itself. But what is bittersweet to me is that when I went back home to the Philippines for the first time in late 2019, it's the first time I went back after I started my gender transition. And when I got there, I just felt really self-conscious about being trans. And that might have been due to the fact that a few months before I flew there, there was a big scandal involving a trans woman in Manila who got dragged out of the women's bathroom by a female security guard and brought all the way to, you know, dragged all the way to a police precinct. You know, it's just a sad and really disturbing feeling to have about the country that I was born in and that I was raised in.
I can definitely understand your conflicting feelings. I was also born in the Philippines, and every time I come home, there's when, you know, when you have two opposing ideas in your head, like, yes, there's this sense of belonging, but at the same time, after culminating so many experiences abroad, you're just sort of shocked at how your other life is so different.
Exactly.
And progressively evolved. And like, it's also nice too, in the sense that you really appreciate the places that you find refuge, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, I can say that the U.S., you know, feels like home to me now. I've had my green card for over 4 years and a half, and in a few months, I'll be eligible to apply for U.S. citizenship. And, you know, my Philippine passport has my old name and gender marker, because the Philippines, about 10 years ago, you know, Congress legislated that trans people cannot change their name and gender marker, just like Olivia's situation in Lingua Franca. But my U.S. green card, you know, has my current legal name, Isabel, and my gender marker.
You literally have two different identities depending on which country you're in.
Exactly. And, you know, once I get my U.S. citizenship, hopefully by end of the year, early next year, I'm going to have to decide whether I want to keep my Philippine citizenship.
That's something I found so interesting in your film, too, is the conversation that Olivia had with her friend in Tagalog about how they're unable to change their passport names, and how that was something that might pose a problem when they're dating.
Yeah, so that part is, I think, autobiographical in the film.
Yeah, I could see. And I love all the little cultural nuances you've incorporated into the film, like the buy-in boxes, the family phone calls, for people to collect allowance.
Yeah, you know, that part too, I find it funny. I mean, my mom hasn't seen Lingua Franca yet. I mean, I'm reluctant to have her see it because, you know, first I have a little nude scene in that, and I just don't know how I would feel, my mom watching it. But also, like, the phone calls that Olivia has with her own mom are literally, like, similar to my own phone calls with my mom. Almost verbatim, and I just find that hilarious.
Yeah. I would love to learn, what are some themes you like to explore in your work? I know you've gone through a little bit about the experiences of a trans woman.
As a filmmaker, I have come to realize, having made three feature films, that I really gravitate towards women with secrets in some sense. And, you know, to be specific, these are also women who are either disempowered or marginalized, you know, in some way, who find themselves confronting intensely personal and private problems and dilemmas within a fraught socio-political setting and context. And that's very evident in Lingua Franca. This is an undocumented trans woman trying to find a path to citizenship in Trump's America. And the previous feature, the feature before that, called Apparition, it's about cloistered nuns who find themselves under siege during the Marcos administration in the early 70s. So that has become my pet theme in my films. The French filmmaker Jean Cocteau once said that a filmmaker makes the same movie over and over again over the course of their career. And that what he means is that essentially filmmakers revisit, you know, similar themes, thematic obsessions and unresolved issues, maybe from their own life, in their work. And as a psychology major, that idea resonates with me very strongly.
What films have inspired you to pursue directing?
The films of Wong Kar-wai have been very formative for me. You know, I watched them when I was in my late teens, early 20s. You know, some of his work, like In the Mood for Love, for instance, and Chungking Express, I think really influenced a generation of cinephiles and aspiring filmmakers about 15 years ago. And it's funny because while my first feature, Senorita, is obviously and explicitly influenced by Wong Kar-wai, with Lingua Franca, I'm not even, you know, consciously or purposefully referencing his style, but some friends of mine who are either film lovers or critics who've seen an earlier cut of Lingua Franca tell me that it reminds them of In the Mood for Love. And even my latest work, the short film Shangri-La, which was commissioned by Miu Miu for Miu Miu Women's Tales. One of my good friends, who's a programmer at MoMA, said that it reminds her of Wong Kar-wai's work.
Yeah, so there's definitely sort of that unintentional imprint.
Yeah, and I think also in terms of my own evolution and growth as a filmmaker, I learned to celebrate and embrace the sensuousness and the core sensuality of the cinematic image.
And I love that too. I don't know if there's some connection here because Wong Kar-wai is also an Asian director. Do you think that something about that sensuality of this region of the world is something that might be like something that draws you in, or is it really just like the stylistic feel of his films?
You know, that's an interesting point. Like, there's really a diverse spectrum of styles and sensibilities in Asian cinema. And I think it's really just our own distinct voice and sensibilities, filmmakers, in that we find the inherent seductiveness in every image. And that's where I am at now in my own filmmaking as well.
I'm so curious to learn, has travel influenced or inspired your work in any way?
I think both traveling physically and the travel that I experience when I immerse myself in works of world cinema from a range of directors like Wong Kar-wai, who's in Hong Kong, and the works of European directors like Ingmar Bergman, who's Swedish, or Fellini, who's Italian. And of course, being here in the U.S. now, the works of Noah Baumbach, who's American. And I think also when I was really traveling quite a bit when Lingua Franca premiered at the Venice Film Festival in 2019, for about 6 months after that, I was really traveling the world. Different film festivals invited me and flew me, so I was able to go to Hamburg in Germany, to Poland, to South Korea, back to the Philippines, to Hawaii as well. And my travels, especially to Europe, really inspired the idea for my upcoming feature film called Tropical Gothic.
Oh, I'm really excited. And what sort of ideas culminated in these trips are you putting into this new film?
I think just my experience, experiencing old Europe, inspired the idea for Tropical Gothic, which is set in the 16th century in the Philippines very early on during the Spanish colonial regime. And it's actually an allegory about colonialism and imperialism. So having traveled to Europe, which is where our former colonizers,
yeah, yes, exactly,
are initially from, it's like it compelled me to think about our history, our Philippine history, in a way that I've never really grappled with or wrestled with internally before.
I think that's really timely too. In wake of all of everything that happened last summer, I've been invited to a lot of Zoom group meetings about decolonizing our mentality.
Yeah.
Because Filipinos are so colonized that it's so heavily embedded in the way that we perceive everything.
Exactly.
I'm really excited to see this.
Thank you. Yeah, and working on this film allows me to really dig into and investigate my own, my own thinking and my own biases as well.
And traveling to film festivals sounds incredibly glamorous. I'm so curious to hear from somebody who actually has to conduct a lot of interviews and sell films. What does a typical day at a film festival look like for you?
When Lingua Franca premiered at Venice, it was a combination of doing press events, like interviews. I was there with Eamon Farron, who plays Alex in the film. So we did some radio interviews. We did some photo shoots and magazine interviews, but I also got to watch a lot of films premiering for the first time. So that was really a thrill and a delight. But it's also, I think, traveling a lot and meeting a lot of strange people at these festivals really was quite emotionally draining for me because I'm an introvert. And so I would just find myself at the end of the day feeling quite exhausted. And so I think after 3 months of intense international travel, I was very happy to go to an artist residency called McDowell in New Hampshire and just, you know, shack up for 5 weeks between Thanksgiving and New Year with a small group of fellow artists and work on my own project. And that's actually where I started writing Tropical Gothic.
And what was that artist residency like?
McDowell is actually one of the two most prestigious artist residencies in the U.S. The other is called Yaddo, which I just came back from as well. It was established, I think, either in 1890s or 1900s, and it has hosted a lot of respected major artists like Henry James, James Baldwin, and artists work in different disciplines. So I was there when I was at McDowell, I was there with playwrights and architects and choreographers and composers. So it's fun that I got to work on my own projects, but every evening we would gather together for dinner and exchange ideas, and we would also have presentations of our respective works. So that was a fun experience.
And did you find that this sort of diverse crowd of different types of artists and different mediums, was that helpful in ideating?
Absolutely, because, you know, you're interacting with people who come from radically different backgrounds, you know, really fascinating ideas that are very different from yours. So it's not like being in an echo chamber and you find your own creative ideas and output really challenged and invigorated by the intellectual exchange that's happening within this very secluded community.
That's beautiful. And to go back a little bit to your travel history, what has been the most formative trip you've taken?
My most formative trip I've taken is actually my very first one. I remember my first trip abroad was to Hong Kong. And this was in, I think, 2005. I flew to Hong Kong to do my interview for NYU, for New York University Stern School of Business. And I just found myself really in awe of, and I fell in love with Hong Kong. And in some ways, it reminds me of San Francisco in that it's so hilly, but it's definitely a major city. And that made me really want to travel a lot. And that the following year, not only did I get to travel, I actually migrated to a totally different country and continent. So that's when I moved to New York.
Had you been to New York prior to moving there for school?
I have not, but I remember in college, I think I was in junior year in college, and I bought this New York travel guidebook. And it's so funny because I was such a huge fan of Sex and the City when it first came out. And so I just told myself,
oh, me too.
Because of Sex and the City, and because I knew that New York was the capital of the independent American, you know, film scene, that I was going to move there. And I visualized moving to New York, and I made a mental note to myself. And a few years later, that's exactly where I found myself in New York City.
I find it so incredibly bold that you moved to New York without having ever stepped foot there. What was this experience like as soon as you landed? Did it meet your expectations? Or do you feel like because you've watched so many films and shows about New York, you kind of had a cadence of what it was going to be like?
I was so hungry culturally when I came to New York, and just devouring, you know, art house cinema, because there are so many art house theaters in New York City. And I, for some reason, I can say that I never really felt like a fish out of water. Even though I'm introverted, I'm an adventurer at heart, and that I want to explore things that are new and strange to me. I remember one of my most memorable experiences the first few months after arriving in New York was going to the opera. I went to the Metropolitan Opera and saw La Boheme, which, you know, most people know, like Rent, the Broadway musical Rent, is essentially inspired by Love of Women, I was blown away because it's like they built an entire town on stage with, you know, so much detail and very similar to it that I was really impressed. And my love affair with New York lasted about 15 years.
That's beautiful. Did you get to watch Fran Lebowitz's Pretend It's a City?
Yes, I saw a few episodes of Pretend It's a City. And New York can be such a fascinating city in that when you leave Manhattan and go to the outer boroughs, like Queens and Brooklyn, it's truly a melting pot of cultures. And I mean that in that where I used to live in Brooklyn, Crown Heights, which has gotten gentrified in the last 10 years, you know, it's not just white hipsters, but, you know, you're surrounded by both Hasidic and Orthodox Jews, which are different from each other. There's also the Caribbean community and the West African community. There's Italians. And like in Lingua Franca, there's also Russian Jews in Brighton Beach. So that, you know, you just take the train from one station to the next. It's like being transported to and whisked off to a totally different culture and a different country.
There's worlds within worlds.
Exactly.
I stuck out most of last year's pandemic there. And honestly, as like a travel writer, it felt really fulfilling being there just because block by block is so different. Chinatown leads you to Little Italy, and you can experience so many different types of concentrated ethnic groups in such a short amount of time. It really felt like a mini world.
Exactly. It's like around the world in like 80 blocks or something.
Exactly, around the world in 80 blocks.
Yeah.
And as a film director, I would love to know, what do you find is like the most cinematic places or moments in the city?
For me, Brighton Beach, Coney Island. And that's why I made a film literally set in those neighborhoods. And that, you know, it's just 30 minutes away from my neighborhood by train. But when I would take the subway from Crown Heights to Brighton Beach, not only do I feel like I'm being transported to a different culture and to a different country, it's also like being transported to a different period in time. It feels like being stuck somehow in the 1950s and the 1960s because of how rooted and anchored the older generation of Russian Jews are to the culture of their home country, both in good and bad ways, in that, you know, they can be quite conservative and in some ways, you know, homophobic and misogynistic. But yeah, it's like experiencing a different culture and a different way of seeing things and worldview.
I read somewhere that you filmed Lingua Franca in a really short amount of time. Mm-hmm. How were you able to match sort of the emotional landscape of the characters with the actual physical landscape? Because I thought that was really well done given the short time frame you guys filmed the entire movie.
You know, it's the magic of editing. I think I was able to shoot Lingua Franca in as short a time as I did. 16 days is considered at least 10 days, you know, shorter than the average independent film shoot. It's because I really had a clear vision of the movie that I wanted to make from the beginning. And that is very important when you are an independent filmmaker and you don't have the luxury of a humongous production budget. And it really helps to be prepared and to do your homework. And I consider myself an auteur in that, you know, I really value and fight for having creative control and autonomy over my work. And so I really needed to step up with Lingua Franca. And I'd like to think that I did as a storyteller.
And that autonomy and creative control with your work, congratulations, by the way, on your beautiful film with Miu Miu. How do you work with brands in maintaining your artistic integrity when you have specific commissions with brands?
Yes, with Miu Miu, it was very easy, and I'm very, very grateful that they reached out to me. You know, Miu Miu Women's Tales has a roster of truly extraordinary women directors from the likes of Ava DuVernay, of course, and who acquired Lingua Franca for North America. as well as Agnes Varda, Lynn Ramsey, and Lucretia Martel, they gave me carte blanche, essentially, as long as I incorporated some of their fashion in my short film, Shangri-La. Moving forward in terms of working for brands when it comes to branded content, I really try to also initially determine whether it's a great fit, you know, in terms of the equity and the values of the brand and what my priorities are and my thematic and stylistic interests as a filmmaker. And so it's really a matter of really seeing if there's chemistry, so to speak, between myself and the brand and the campaign that they're working on. And I'm actually very close to getting signed as a director for commercials by a prestigious commercial production agency. And I hope to be able to announce that in the next few weeks once it becomes final.
On that note, what are some other projects you're working on?
Yes, aside from Tropical Gothic, I am currently developing a TV series, a crime drama for FX. I also am adapting a memoir by Filipino-American trans writer Meredith Caluzan. Her book is called Fairest, and I'm adapting that potentially into a TV series for Topic Studios.
I'm really excited about all of your different projects coming out because I really think you're bringing Filipino storytelling with all the other verticals and themes that you have and really pushing it into the main stage.
Thanks, Leva. Yeah, I mean, Filipino-American artists are here and we're only getting started. And I hope that the critical success of Lingua Franca really empowers and emboldens not just Filipino-American artists, but minority storytellers in general, that if we really choose to tell our stories our own way without compromise and without watering them down or pandering to a broad audience just for the sake of accessibility, then our work as artists will really shine and distinguish ourselves from what the rest are making.
Has this sort of artistic integrity always been the driving force behind your work, or was it something that you had to develop over time in learning to be more confident?
It's definitely been there from the start, but my confidence and my voice has only grown stronger and more pronounced, you know, with every new project that I take on. I'm also very much an adventurous artist in that I love taking creative risks and being very ambitious in my work. And with every undertaking that I've made, those risks and those gambles have paid off. And if they got me to where I am at this point in my career, I'm not going to stop taking risks now. And I'm going to continue doing so and being more ambitious.
I love that. Do you have any parting advice for any aspiring directors?
Yeah. Do not be afraid to take risks. You know, it's usually when you're starting out that you have the most freedom, the most autonomy to make the work that you want to make. So take advantage of that. And the industry tends to make us think that it's conforming to formula or convention that will help us to succeed, but that's not always the case. But it's truly being authentic in terms of who you are as an artist that, in my experience, has become the foolproof path to not just making it in the industry, but to truly evolve as an artist as well.
Well, Isabel, thank you so much. I think that was such a lovely conversation, and I'm so delighted to be able to talk to you and learn more about your process and you yourself.
Maris, thank you so much, Olivia. It's such a delight to speak with you.
To find Isabel, you can find her at Isabel Sandoval on Instagram or watch Lingua Franca, now streaming on Netflix.
Tune in every Tuesday for a new episode on the Art of Travel podcast. Subscribe to the Art of Travel podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you may stream your favorite podcasts. The Art of Travel is created by Olivia Lopez, produced by Bon Weekender, edited by Jason Stewart, and music composed by Slow Shiver. We'll see you on Tuesday.